215826, William Norad et al. Versus Tennessee Department of Intellectual et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Parker for, is Ms. Magnuson's. For comment.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Hillary Magosh, and I represent the plaintiff's appellants in this matter, or William F. Norad and LaWanda Jean Norad, as conservators, next friends, and parents of William F. Norad Jr., who prefers to be called Bill. And first, my clients are actually here today in the court. They're in from Knoxville, and I just want to briefly acknowledge them to the court. That is Mr. and Mrs. Norad, and Bill is sitting there with them, and Bill's brother Drew is also here today. So turning now to the issues, and first, I don't remember if I said, but we would request 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
All right.
But turning to the issues, first, the district court erred in finding that the defendant's appellees did not violate the Medicaid Act. Bill and his parents are here today because the defendants failed in their duty to provide him with medical assistance with reasonable promptness. Now, as this court is aware, 42 U.S.C. 1396AA8 provides that medical assistance shall be furnished with reasonable promptness to all eligible individuals. And AA10 provides that a state plan for medical assistance must provide medical assistance to eligible individuals. So there's no dispute that Bill is eligible for medical assistance, and there's no dispute that he needs it.
Let me ask you this. I guess the response to your arguments would be that the government has fulfilled its responsibilities by finding, by being willing to pay for the care, which they say they are, and by identifying a willing provider or providers willing to accept payment, and they would say they fulfill that requirement by finding any number and quite numerous providers and have provided care from time to time, but as of late have not been able to identify any providers who are willing to or been able to come to agreement with your clients regarding the conditions of the care to be provided, but the argument is that they've demonstrated a willingness to pay and to identify providers who might accept payment, and consequently they fulfill their responsibility. Why is that not a willing argument for your opposing counsel?
Well, Your Honor, so you're correct in that the defendants allege that merely being willing to pay is enough to satisfy their duty to provide.
Well, they did more than that. They at least they claimed they provided lists of providers and arranged interviews and attempted to recruit providers and went out of their way in that regard, but there have been they haven't been either the providers have not been willing or able to provide the care, or no agreement has been reached pursuant to which the care could be provided. In other words, I suppose the argument would be the Medicaid Act doesn't guarantee that the care would be provided in all instances. It depends upon what the burden or difficulty turns out to be. And in this case, purportedly, there are any number of problems that have prevented caretakers, allegedly, that it, at least to coming to agreement with your clients to provide the care under the conditions that your clients would find satisfactory?
Well, Your Honor, the bill has been found to be eligible for home and community-based services in his community. He had been receiving services in Sevierville, so it's not a question of whether he is eligible or that he could receive services. There's no doubt that he had been receiving services. However, his former provider, New Haven, there were issues, there was abuse, and there were complaints made about that abuse, did investigate it and substantiated that abuse. And so since that time, New Haven actually, they provided a letter of intent to discharge Bill as their client. And when a provider does that, they actually can't just stop providing services. They have to continue providing until another provider is in place. And so the NORADs were looking for another provider, a willing provider, and one had not yet been found. And then in 2018, when his individual support plan was submitted to the plans review unit, New Haven wasn't listed and another provider wasn't listed. And so at that point, New Haven, which had a responsibility to continue providing care, was actually removed from the ISP. And he's not been able to find another willing provider in the area. But the goal of the home and the community-based services program is to integrate people with disabilities into their communities.
But I understand that the Department of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities has provided literally dozens of names of potential providers, and some of them have even interviewed your client and his parents and have attempted to ascertain whether they could enter into a relationship. So it's not that the department has left your client adrift. They would claim, I think, based on the record, that they've made more than a good faith effort to pair him with providers who would accommodate his needs, and have frankly been unable to do so.
Your Honor, while there has been a provider list, and there have been providers who have expressed interest, they've ultimately all turned down the opportunity to care for Bill. And so the definition of medical assistance, when it was changed, and if you look at the change in definition and the legislative history behind that change, it becomes clear that the definition of medical assistance means both payment and provision of care and services. So somebody receives medical assistance with reasonable promptness when they both the payment and the provision of care and services are made with reasonable promptness. And that's regardless of whether it's a DID authorized provider or whether it would be DID itself providing that service. So someone could receive medical assistance with reasonable promptness than when payment is provided reasonably promptly and the care and services are provided with reasonable promptness. And so therefore, DID would meet its...
You're saying that that there is a guarantee of medical assistance intended by these provisions?
Yes, Your Honor. It means...
And you're saying that it's up to the state, but they've got to do it by one of these ways.
Yes, Your Honor. According to the legislative history, the intent is it means both payment and provision. And they can satisfy their duty by either promptly paying a DID-authorized provider who then provides these services with reasonable promptness. They could provide the services directly with reasonable promptness, or they can engage in a combination of both, just providing one service directly and hiring somebody to provide the other services.
Doesn't the legislative history, in fact, say the direct opposite? The House report on the 2010 amendment states, and I quote, "This is a technical correction is made to conform this definition to the longstanding administrative use." If it's a technical correction, and that means it is not a substantive change. And the law of our circuit has been that the obligation is satisfied if the state makes payment or is willing to make payment, and they do not have to provide services themselves. That's what our case law has said. So how does a technical correction change our case law?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the case law says merely being willing to pay is enough. If there was a provider that they could provide payment to, the NORADs and Bill would be happy to accept that. Bill just would like to have the care and services.
The West Side Mothers 2 case from 2006 doesn't say that. I mean, I thought I read that they said that the obligation is satisfied if the state is willing to make payment. No?
Your Honor, my understanding of that case is that the obligation is satisfied if, at the time that the court ruled, that it would be satisfied if they make payment to a provider, that a state only has to make payment to satisfy their obligation. However, again, the definition when
okay,
it,
well, here how do they make payment when nobody can find a willing provider?
And that's exactly our argument. So
well,
here
then your argument is that they have to put a service, their own service person in the house? Or what would you have them do, I guess?
Well, Your Honor, of course, Bill, he would love to get back to his home in Sevierville. His parents have bought that for him. He's comfortable there. But it's about more than just that home for him. So it's about the community of Sevierville. He would like to live in that community. It's not about that particular house. He, of course, would like to get back to it. But if there's no willing provider, and here is somebody who has had he has had a lot of medical difficulties throughout his life, and he is qualified to receive care and services. He had unfortunately had to have half of his brain removed.
What would you have the state do?
Provide him with services until a willing caregiver is provided.
With their own services?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. They don't have it. I understand they have residential homes that they'll treat him and care for him, but he doesn't want to go into a residential home. Do they have staff right now that goes to individuals' homes?
Your Honor, I believe they, and I don't want to speak for them, but I believe they would say they don't.
Yeah.
However, they obviously have staff in the ICFs, and I can't remember exactly what that term stands for, but they do provide the exact same level of services, the 24-hour day, 7-day a week type of care in those intermediate care facilities. And so
I know he would like to be treated in his home, in his own home, in his own community, but why is he objecting to the residential home treatment that they're willing to do?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. So the home and community-based Medicaid waiver, it's in place so that individuals don't have to be institutionalized. So if someone's able to live in the community, and so he has been found eligible to live in the community.
Are these homes with, I think, four clients and placed in communities, is that regarded as institutionalization or is that community-based?
Your Honor, I'm not 100% clear on that, but to Bill, he has been found not to be able to have roommates. He has intermittent explosive disorder. He's not able to live in homes with other.
Do these residential homes, I mean, does he have to have a roommate there, or would he have his own bedroom?
Your Honor, I believe that it's a group home and that he would be living in that home.
Yeah, in a home, but he'd have his own room, wouldn't he?
I'm not sure of that, Your Honor.
But has anybody ever determined that that's an inappropriate placement for him?
Your Honor,
it's a matter of preference.
Well, Your Honor, if someone has been determined to be found to be able to live in their own home in the community receiving that type of care, then then that is the care that they're entitled to receive in the community.
Well, what is the state to do if the state can't find anybody who would be qualified as willing to go to his home in Sevierville to care for him there? If they literally, either state employee or a caretaker, whomever there might be, if they can't find anybody, what is the state to do?
Again, Your Honor, they do have individuals who are trained to provide these care and services at the level 6 24-hour-a-day level. So,
well, I thought the only source for that that had been identified for your client was this New Haven organization, and there had been a disagreement or a lack of compatibility between the family and that organization, such that they were not available any longer to offer the care, and that was the only one that was able to care for him in Sevierville. Is that not the case?
Well, Your Honor, so there's a couple aspects to that question. At the time, New Haven was again providing these services to Bill. The NORADs didn't have issues with New Haven until several caretakers began abusing Bill. Did investigate.
Well, allegedly. I mean, that was never adjudicated. Claimed that your client was overly aggressive and things like that. I mean, there were counter-allegations going back and forth about all that, was there not?
Did actually investigate it and substantiated abuse against multiple New Haven caretakers. And there was actually litigation that ensued with New Haven over those over that abuse. It ended up, unfortunately, getting, I think it was dismissed on a motion to dismiss, possibly, because it was a procedural issue. And so, but abuse was substantiated against several of the New Haven caretakers.
Substantiated and, how?
They
not,
said.
Not in a court.
No, it was an internal investigation.
By the state?
By the state, yes, Your Honor. And so, New Haven, though, regardless, was supposed to continue providing these care and services to Bill. They had an obligation pursuant to DID's own policies.
I'd like to ask a question about that because I'm a bit confused. So, New Haven declares that they want to discharge him as a client or patient.
Yes, Your Honor.
But they continue to be listed. So during that period of time, were the NORADs requesting services that New Haven wasn't performing, or was it just sort of an agreement that, I guess during that period of time, New Haven wanted to bring him to, is it Sevierville?
Sevierville. Bill's home, he'd actually been receiving services in Sevierville.
Right.
That's where his home is. December of 2016 is when they submitted their letter of intent to discharge him. And after that time, they had to continue providing services under the policy and procedure. And so services were being provided. But during that time, the abuse or the complaints of abuse continued. And in October of 2017,
where were they providing those services?
Sevierville.
Okay.
And then in October of 2017, Mr. and Mrs. NORAD temporarily took Bill to their home because there had been a particularly upsetting instance involving a physical altercation, I believe, with Bill and a caretaker. And so they took him to their own home in Knoxville. And at that point, after October of 2017, New Haven was not providing any further services.
And that was at the request of the NORADs because of the abuse?
Yes, and they were not trying to move him permanently to Knoxville. They had simply told New Haven, hey, listen, we've got this abuse occurring. You know, this is this is happening to Bill, and we just need to have some better trained people, you know, to make sure we can care for him.
So they were still on the file. They requested that they not attend the meetings, and again for the next year, so they weren't listed. But during that period, were the NERDs requesting services from New Haven?
Yes, Your Honor, they were. And New Haven was not providing the care and services, and they weren't providing staff, trained staff, to provide these care and services to Bill.
What type of services were they requesting?
Your Honor, I'd have to look at the ISP, but he needs 24-hour a day.
Were they requesting those services of New Haven?
Yes, Your Honor. And so New Haven, despite this sort of at this point contentious relationship because of these allegations of abuse, was still on this ISP, which, again, this gets, there's an annual process, and every year they determine what things are needed and the types of care, all of the goals, and they have a meeting every year to discuss that. In 2017, New Haven did not sign that ISP. It got submitted to DID, and DID approved it. In 2018, the same process occurred. New Haven did not sign the ISP. However, New Haven was not listed on the ISP. And Mrs. Norred actually wrote a little note on this ISP that said, hey, I disagree with this. New Haven is supposed to be listed as the provider. There's no other provider. But
there were no services at all provided under that 2017.
After October of 2017.
Okay.
You know, I think I saw on the record some indication that Mr. and Mrs. Norred had indicated they might be willing to take over the care of their son if the state would agree to pay them the compensation that would be paid to a caregiver. And the state had, I suppose, had indicated that's not something they could work out for reasons that I'm not sure what the reasons were, but because of the, in other words, if the compensation were made available to the parents, they would take their son and provide for him as the caregiver. Is that correct?
So, yes, Your Honor, there is an option where you can become, and I can't remember the exact term, but essentially a home provider for somebody. There's many, many steps to becoming such a provider, a lot of regulations and guidelines and just things you have to do to be a provider. And unfortunately, the NORADs, that was something they were trying to do.
They're not willing to take them without the compensation.
Well, that's the compensation isn't, I mean, it is an issue, but they are in very poor health themselves. Mr. Norred has cancer. He's undergoing cancer treatments. Mrs. Norred is confined to a wheelchair, and she's had several mini strokes. So,
but they were taken with the compensation. They're not so debilitated that they wouldn't take over his care if they were capable, if they could be compensated, from what I understand you to be saying.
No, I believe that they tried to do this and realized this was just not an option for them due to their own health issues.
Let me ask you about one other thing. The there seemed to be a requirement that your client had that he didn't want to be cared for by African Americans, and also some indication he required or had a preference for female caregivers. And obviously for the state to designate or provide caregivers based on race and gender would not even be legal. Why should his application be entertained at all if he has these kinds of requirements?
So, Your Honor, the district court's opinion, if you were to just read it, would paint this picture that he did have, that the NORADs had these unreasonable race and gender restrictions. But the prove at trial did not establish that. That is not the case. They don't have these unreasonable restrictions.
Well, it's right in the record that they've expressed these ideas that he couldn't be satisfied without white females as his caregivers.
So, and I'm just going to give just a brief background to get to that, so I do want to answer that. But so how this all came, I guess, about Bill, when he was young, he underwent a procedure. He had half of the right side of his brain is gone. It's removed to deal with a seizure condition. And so later on, at some point, he was institutionalized, and he unfortunately suffered physical and sexual abuse while he was institutionalized. It did happen to be a group of African-American men who had abused him, and he did not understand, because he doesn't process things the way that others might, but he didn't understand that the race and gender had absolutely nothing to do with what happened to him. He worked through that issue when he got to Sevierville. By that time, he had plenty of all, you know, everybody caring for him, including African-American males and females, and there were no problems.
Well, wait a minute. Eventually, there was one African-American male who actually filed the EEOC complaint because of racial allegations, and he was caring for your client, claiming that he was untrue allegations were made against him simply because of his race.
And, Your Honor, is this Mr. Kisa who filed?
Riley, wasn't it? Wasn't it?
Your Honor,
I'm not sure I remember the correct name, but it's in the record here.
I apologize for not knowing the name, but so New Haven, when they were providing care and services. Again, these certain caretakers were substantiated for abuse. One of those caretakers ended up filing or sending a death threat to the NORADs and to Bill.
My problem is I don't see where your clients have retracted their requirement. You say that there's been a change in thinking and all that, but I don't see anywhere in the record that they've retracted those sorts of racial preferences. And my question is, if those still exist, is your client even eligible to be considered for any of this, these benefits?
Your Honor, they don't exist. That request or...
Well, I know you say that, but where in the record have your client said that?
Your Honor...
Is it somewhere in the record I could go to and find that?
They, in the record, did say that they'd be willing to accept care from New Haven again. They didn't...
Well, then that's different. Yeah, New Haven has people of all different ethnicities and genders and all that. Just saying that doesn't mean anything. Where in the record have your clients said that they no longer will be discriminatory based on race or gender?
Your Honor.
And that's a simple question.
I can't point to a page in the record, but I will say that they don't believe that they were discriminatory. Bill himself.
Well, I know you say that, but people can discriminate without believing that their actions and words constitute discrimination.
That request was not. It was relayed to, and again, it was Bill's request. It should not have been repeated, to that particular provider. However, it was one provider. This is a process to get to the meet and greet point. They first circulate a referral program or a sheet, and then if they're interested, they circulate the longer ISP, and if they're interested after that, they have a meet and greet. And so that request was relayed to one single provider, and the proof at trial showed that provider decided to not care for Bill because they couldn't provide him with 24-hour-a-day care. And
all right. I think we have your position in hand, and you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Amber Barker, and I represent the defendants appellees in this appeal. Excuse me, the Tennessee Department of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and its commissioner, Brad Turner. Your Honors, for years, the department has been attempting to pay for Medicaid benefits for Bill, an eligible recipient, only for those attempts to be prevented by the NORADs, Bill's parents and conservators, and the plaintiffs of this case. The district court correctly denied the NORADs' request for declaratory and injunctive relief because the NORADs themselves created the barriers and the restrictions that prevented payment for services for Bill.
Well, look, you spent a lot of time looking for a service provider, and I think there's clearly a question of fact regarding whether they insisted on white females. There's certainly evidence that at some point they go, no, that is, you know, we're not insisting on that. So then we get to the geography, which I understand is the main reason why places won't serve them.
It is at least one reason. I don't know if we could definitively say it's the main reason. The testimony that was credited by the district court was that of Stephanie Hernandez, who was the independent support coordinator for most of this time. She testified that she couldn't find a provider due to the restrictions of location, the cameras being in the home, and the preference for white females. And so I don't know if we can necessarily pull out one individual factor and say that that is the main reason or the...
Okay, so is cameras being in the home unreasonable when there has been prior abuse?
In and of itself, probably not, Your Honor. If the only restriction at issue here were just the surveillance cameras, there probably wouldn't be any issue finding a provider. It's the whole pot altogether. Having the restrictions on who can serve as staff members in the home, having restrictions on the cameras, having restrictions on the location, and having Bill live alone and not having a roommate, all of that combined made it certainly just almost impossible to find a provider that was willing to agree to all of these standards.
So, as I understand it, the problem with the homes that you provide is the distance from where he lives, right? There was never any finding that he's not an appropriate client for a home, was there?
That's correct, Your Honor. He is properly in the home and community-based waiver program. The intermediate care facilities, I think that you're referencing, are a separate program, okay. And it's a heightened standard. So it's instead of having individuals and institutions, this is kind of the happy medium between that. Okay. So there are community settings still, but it is for individuals in a home.
Okay. So there are two different categories. And
yes.
He is in a different category.
Yes. He is in a category where he is actually able to be out in the community in a home, whether by himself or with a housemate.
What do you do? I mean, I don't know. Chattanooga, I'm not that familiar, but it doesn't sound very, like, out of the way. Isn't that a big city?
Knoxville? I don't know what you're referring to. I'm sorry.
You
mean Knoxville.
Knoxville. I'm sorry. Knoxville. Isn't that a big city?
It is. It is a big city, Your Honor. And I think it just goes back to just the multitude of restrictions and also what the restrictions are. I think it's very difficult to convince a provider to agree to terms such as only having female staff in the home.
But is that what you were putting out, a request for only female providers?
So the individual support plans did not have this on there, and that is correct. However, Mrs. Norad herself testified that she made her female preference known to providers. And then there is the meet and greet in which the preference about not having African-American males was known, and two of the individuals on behalf of the provider at that meeting were African-American males, and that's documented in Exhibit 57 from the trial.
So you're saying that that in the meet and greets, it was expressed that we don't want black men in the house?
The record shows that there was at least one meet and greet where that was explicitly said.
And does the record show whether those requirements were passed on to these phone calls that were made periodically to 50, 60?
It's not clear in terms of how far that went. Again, we have the one meet and greet where the preference against African-American males was explicitly made, and then Mrs. Norad testified that she made her female preference known to providers. It doesn't go further in terms of how extensive that was. But again, the ISC, who was the one who was contacting these providers and talking to them, she testified that, that these were the reasons why she couldn't find a provider: the staff restrictions, the location restrictions, and the cameras. And so, and these restrictions are well documented in the record. The district court did find that there was a restriction against having men staff members, and specifically African American men staff members. The court found that in pages 4 and 5 of its opinion. And it is established in the record as well. We had several people that testified about these restrictions. The NORADs themselves acknowledged that they had these preferences. And there was no medical necessity ever documented at any point. Again, it's not in the ISPs that this is a requirement. This is just a preference that the NORADs have turned into essentially a restriction that's prevented anybody from agreeing to work with them.
So is it fair to say that one of your positions is that, even assuming that direct services are required, which you're not conceding, you're saying even assuming, it wouldn't be required under circumstances where we tried to pay for services and it was the client's fault that we were unable to do that?
If we are assuming that direct services can be a requirement, I think where we have a situation such as this, where it is essentially the clients that have prevented the payment of services, I don't think that necessarily demands direct provision of services either, because the state is trying to fulfill and is working through its obligation to provide medical assistance through payment, and that is being frustrated by the NORADs themselves here.
What would happen if somebody lived in a place that was really remote? They've been qualified through the procedures for in-home care, and you're just not able to find someone who can provide that 24-hour care in that location. Then what happens?
So we don't really have anything specifically on the record about what that would look like. I'm guessing that it would be a situation where we have to really look at the network and whether that's adequate. And I think that would be more akin to this court's recent opinion in Waspel versus Washtenaw County Community Mental Health, and that's in 2020. In that case, Michigan had changed its budget methodology, and the plaintiffs were alleging that this change in budgeting resulted in a lower pay rate for providers, and that they were no longer able to find providers that were willing to work at this new lower pay rate. And so in that situation, this court did remand and over a motion to dismiss, finding that at least there was enough alleged to show a potential violation. And then that is a good contrast to this situation, in which there is nothing that the state's doing to prevent these providers from agreeing to work with the NORADs. All of these restrictions were created by the NORADs, as the district court found. And it's something that we cannot agree to do either. If we do direct services, we cannot agree to discriminate against staff on the basis of race or sex, especially where there's no documentation at all that that's necessary medically. I also want to note there was some questions about the single placement agency application, in which the NORADs were given the opportunity to apply to get that funding directly, and they could hire their own staff, have more control.
Can you do that? That was one of the questions I was going to ask. If they had been certified, would they be able to use that money to pay somebody else to provide the services?
Yes, and that's precisely what that program is. And they did start that application. It's a two-part application. They finished the first part of it, and that was approved by the department. They were in the process of working on the second part of that application when they hired new legal counsel and withdrew their application. And so, again, that was a choice that the NORADs make to not be the providers themselves and have that control that they seem to be wanting here. And this is also consistent with the definition of medical assistance. As has already been mentioned, Westside Mothers 2 in 2006, this court found that the definition of medical assistance provided for payment of services and not direct provision of services. That definition was amended 4 years later in 2010 to be payment of part or all of the cost of the following care services, or the care and services themselves, or both. And the use of the word or here is very important because or is disjunctive. It provides different options, alternative equal options that the state can choose to employ. And here, the department is trying to fulfill its obligation through payment of services.
But they haven't. I think it's clear that they could do that, but they haven't provided payment for the services.
They haven't since the last time that New Haven billed in October of 2017, and that, again, is only because the NORADs have not been able to find a provider willing to meet their demands. And so the services themselves are not a problem. The department has already pre-authorized the services, saying that they're medically necessary, they're covered, we will fund them, but you just need to find a provider. And unfortunately, these restrictions just have made it impossible.
Okay, so let's say that the problem was problem in getting providers had nothing to do with the NORADs. Then what?
I think that, again, goes back to this court's opinion in Waskell, where it might be a different situation, and there could potentially be a violation depending on the specific facts at issue.
But you're saying the state wouldn't have the obligation to provide medical assistance in one form or the other. Like, if they're not providing it through payment, would they then have to provide it through direct services?
If it's a situation where the state is not paying, and it is because of the state, something that's happened, such as, you know, budget changes, like in Waskell, then maybe they do have to fulfill that obligation somehow, and then they could choose to do that through either the payment, provision of services, or a combination of the both. And so,
but you're saying if it's a matter that they can't find somebody, they just don't have to provide the medical assistance.
We're saying that we are still meeting our obligation because we are trying to pay, and it's just being prevented by the recipients themselves.
Hypothetical. It's not the recipient.
And if it is something that the state is directly causing, then they probably would have to provide services.
I'm not saying they are. I'm saying that there's an obligation to provide the medical assistance. They are not doing it by paying somebody because they can't find anybody, but there is an obligation to provide the assistance. So why don't they then have to provide the service?
If, and taking all blame out of the equation.
Yes.
I think they would still have to do something. So whether it's payment, whether it's provision, or it's a combination of both, and that's what the definition is designed to do, is to give the state three different options that they can operate under. And here we are meeting our obligation under the payment aspect of this medical assistance definition, because we are ready to pay and we want to pay, but we just need a provider that is willing to meet their terms. I do want to also highlight some of the history that happened with New Haven, since there were some questions on that. The letter of discharge from New Haven did come out in December of 2016, and they did continue to provide care for another 10 months. And it was ultimately the NORADs who removed Bill from the Sevierville home and put him in their Knoxville home. And because the ISP that had previously been approved by that point had the Sevierville home as the location of the services, New Haven had to provide services at that location to be able to bill for that.
But is it the case that during those 10 months, that's when the substantiated abuse occurred?
I believe the substantiated abuse occurred both in 2016 and 2017. And I apologize, I don't remember which one was when. But most of that substantiated abuse was neglect issues, where New Haven then just retrained their staff. There was only the one incident of abuse that led to termination of that employee. But New Haven did continue to provide services, and at least attempt to provide services. And so they would try to take Bill from Knoxville back to Sevierville to give him the services he needed. Staff were complaining that they were being berated by the NORADs. At one point, they threatened to call the police when a staff member showed up at their house to provide services. And so essentially, they were just refusing the services from New Haven. And when the 2018 ISP was submitted, it did not ask for any of the services that had been previously provided by New Haven. It only asked for dental and ISC services, and both of those were approved. And so now we're in this position where, again, we can't find a provider because of all of these restrictions that the NORADs have put into place. And so requiring the department now to go back and try to provide these services would not only result in hiring and training of new staff, it would also result in potential floodgates of other individuals receiving services wanting to also be treated specially. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, relating to New Haven being removed from the ISP, we potentially would not be here today if New Haven had not been left off the 2018 ISP. He would still have a provider, and we wouldn't be in a situation where he's been searching for a provider since that time, and he can't find a willing provider. There is a continuity of care policy to ensure situations like the one we're in here today don't occur. And DID is the agency that administers this Medicaid waiver program. It writes policies and procedures. It reviews the ISPs. It approves and accepts ISPs and changes to services. It provides quality assurance. It contracts with caregivers. And so to argue that they're not at fault for Bill not having any care and services today it's very problematic because, again, he is eligible for these care and services and been found to be able to live in a community, and yet he has not had services since October of 2017. No payment.
Is there a request for New Haven to resume services?
Yes, Your Honor. So at the time, specifically at the time the ISP was being drafted during this annual meeting, Mrs. Norad actually wrote
2018.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there was a request that they not be there, or they just didn't come?
So, Your Honor, at the time that this ISP was being drafted, litigation was still going on with New Haven. And so the NORAD's attorneys advised them not to communicate directly with New Haven. And so the NORAD's actually contacted John Craven, and he's the regional director for the East Tennessee office of DID, and they asked him to facilitate a meeting with the attorneys for New Haven and for DID. And their attorneys. And unfortunately, that request was turned down. That meeting never occurred. And so this meeting, this ISP meeting happened, and New Haven was left off the ISP. And then that gets sent to the plans review unit at DID, which approves or rejects any changes in services.
Could they have appealed that in some way?
Yes, Your Honor, they did appeal the denial of services, and they were told that we're willing to provide services to you or willing to pay services for you.
So could they have appealed the removal of New Haven?
Your Honor, I believe that they appealed when their services were denied based on the removal of New Haven. And so they were told that, well, New Haven didn't sign the ISP, and so therefore it was fine to remove them, and by the way, we're willing to pay for services, and so therefore we're meeting our obligation to you.
Well, were the services themselves removed from?
Your Honor, yes. So the services that were listed on this ISP were just dental and services, and there may have been one other one, but it wasn't a medical service provided by New Haven. The reason no other services were listed was because a provider who provides those services was not listed, and so no services were listed because the provider was removed. And DID, who again operates this program and approves and accepts or rejects ISPs, approved the ISP. And they had known since December of 2016 that the NORADs had been searching for another caregiver and that one had not been found.
And then they appealed that. And how does that work, that appeal?
Your Honor, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, but from my understanding, they appealed when they were denied services. So they appealed not having a provider, not having these services. They were told their appeal is denied because they were willing to pay for services and that the NORAs just hadn't identified a willing provider. And the NORADs, the ISC, who is the Independent Support Coordinator, Stephanie Hernandez, she actually did testify at trial that the majority of the providers that had been contacted about potentially providing care for Bill had turned Bill down because they didn't provide level six services, which was that 24-hour a day, 7-day a week care. They didn't have enough staff members to do so. And then finally, the preferences that were spoken about, again, these were not circulated at any point in the ISPs, and there were very few meet and greets. And so the majority of these providers did turn down caring for Bill just based on his ISP. It had nothing to do with any of the allegations regarding race or gender. And as far as...
So you might want to start winding up. Your red light's been on for
Thank you, Your Honor.
A while now.
I just have one more question. Did you make any of the types of claims that relate to assuring sufficient providers or assuring the obligation to make sure that the medical care is available, as in the Wasco case?
Could you rephrase your question once more? I'm sorry.
If in fact the problem is that there just aren't any providers for these services in this area, did you make any claim based on that fact that defendants have not fulfilled their responsibilities because they haven't assured adequate medical care for the community?
Well, Your Honor, our arguments were more focused on the fact that to provide medical assistance, you either provide it directly, you pay somebody else, or you engage in a combination. So as far as I guess the inadequate...
Okay. I understand.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the case is submitted.